As you can see from the title screen, we are looking at the Lord's Prayer as a Guide for Fathers, Part 2. And so, dragging over from Father's Day last week, I have declared a dispensation that Father's Day is for 2 weeks this year. So, men, we are to gain all the benefits of that. And, unfortunately for you, that means two sermons that more or less will tear our hide off. And I think it's good that we be challenged as men to be men, especially in a world that I believe devalues men, and probably for some very good reasons. That the example of manhood is not being properly or well acted out by so many men in our world today. Now, what we're doing is looking at Matthew chapter 6, verses 9 through 13. However, only briefly, sort of the introduction that allows us to move to another passage of Scripture that we'll come to eventually. And the reason for that is in Matthew chapter 5, verse 48, same context of Scripture called the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus at that point is speaking to those who are his disciples, people who are followers of him. And his exhortation in chapter 5, verse 48 is to be perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. And so what he's doing is drawing in God the Father as an example to us. Now, that's certainly true for all men, all of mankind. But being Father's Day, we're focusing in on what that means for us as men. And we're looking then at the Lord's Prayer, which clearly speaks of God as the Father and seeing that as a guide, as it were, for us as men. Why, if I would be perfect like my Father in heaven is perfect, then I would be the sort of man I ought to be. Well, here's the Lord's Prayer. I can look at how God the Father is, what he does, and I will endeavor to emulate that, to be perfect like he is. And we're going to again read these verses together. And note, just as you're reading through, let this mind sort of thought be in your mind, that the primary purposes that God gives for a man in relation to, first, his family, and also to society as a whole, is that we protect and we provide. All right, now let's go ahead then and read those verses together, which follow the statement, after this manner, therefore, pray ye. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. It ought to be then that we example the Father, and that our family, as it were, and I say pray, not in the sense of treating us like God, but asking or requesting of us, Father, or Father of my children, do this for us. Now, you can see that it's no stretch at all to see this as a guide, as a father. You can see there in chapter 6, verse 9, our Father. And also you'll see that the emphasis is on a kingdom. See how the two go together? That the Father has a realm of rule, his dominion, his place of leadership. He is not like God, who has the whole of the universe under his control. But every man has a dominion, a realm of rule over which they are placed in charge by God. And so you note then that there is linked with that as well. This mandate that we be men who are hallowed. Now let me just use the word respect. We are men who are respected. You can see that as well. It ends this way in verse 13. Again, kingdom is the focus. And with that kingdom, you have power. That is, realm of rule over which you have authority or power. It ought to be that the way you exercise that power brings glory, that you're honored for that, that you receive the reverence that you deserve because you are doing what you are supposed to be doing in your realm of rule. And we note, too, that this is our work. This is our responsibility. Jesus said, "My Father works hitherto, and I work." So God is not finished with his work. What needs work? Well, he looked around recently. His will is done in heaven, but not on earth. And so God, because sin entered into his dominion, got to work. And in getting to work, his goal is to bring this earth back under his control. So let me just note, with I trust you will accept humility and difficulty in saying this. If in your home, men, you are not reverenced, that is your fault. It may not be that what has happened or is happening is something that you did wrong, but probably is. Even if it's not, though, your responsibility still as the head, the king in the kingdom, as it were, to get to work and get it back the way it should be. So if your rule is not honored and it is not in submission to you, then that's what you're supposed to do. Get to work and do something about it. All right, let's move back again. And we're still in a sort of a review of last week and noting Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 28, where all of this begins, because God is not someone who hasn't given work to all of his creation. And you can notice it there in verse 28, God is blessing them, and this is the husband and the wife, man and woman. And he says to them, "Be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, and subdue it." There's your work. "Have dominion over it." And there it's listed out. "Fish of the sea, fowl of the air, every living thing that moveth upon the earth." And so what we have from the very beginning is the statement that work is not something that is evil in and of itself. Now, I recognize it's difficult because of sin in our world. But that doesn't mean that even in a perfect environment, which it was a perfect environment when those verses were written, you can see work already existed. So what we would understand then is that creation is supposed to be better off when we're done with it than when we began, or we should leave the earth a better place than when we arrived. And we do that by exercising dominion there in verse 28 over our extent of control in creation. But that's not an end in itself, that the world is just a better place. It's to be used towards the betterment of God and man. So God is honored by how we've treated his creation, and the rest of creation is benefited by our work. So we're not working for just our own benefit, not to just use it on ourselves and take advantage of all that we have. No, we use it to serve, to be honoring God and bringing benefit to our fellow man. And from that, then, we came back to a phrase that I repeated numerous times last week and will as well this week, sort of a way of putting it. especially to us as men, that being, or a big part rather, of being a man in this world, is to set your mind and heart on something, and then going and getting it. And when I say setting your mind and heart on it, again, I'm not saying go spoil or rape and pillage the creation. No, you're using the creation to make it a better place out of love for God and for man. All right, let's continue then and note that for us to be that sort of a person, to really justify what it means to be a man, to fulfill the measure of a man, we ought to look at life in this way and set about for that task, finding what it is that we're charged with by God, and then making it better than it currently is. And who better to ask how to be that sort of a man than a woman? And so we're turning to Proverbs chapter 31. Because what we find there is the words of a king in verse 1, King Lemuel. But he is merely relating to us as men a prophecy or words that his mother taught him. And so the queen mother speaks to the prince and is saying, this, son, is what you need to know when you're going to be king. So you see that idea again? The king, the dominion, your realm of rule. And what we find her saying is that any man who is going to fulfill his creation mandate as a king over a realm of rule needs to be someone who is, first of all, the right kind of man. We'll be getting verse 10 to what also is included in that, because for the majority of men, what that involves as well, as in going or finding what it is that you're going to do and then going and getting it, that includes a wife. And any man who is married should be able to say, you know what, I can get a lot more done in this kingdom when my helper, my help fit for me, my partner in this, is working along with me. So looking for a wife is part of that. All right, what we're looking at then is Proverbs chapter 31, and we're going to focus in on verses 3 through 9. And what we find there are three areas of rule that a man must master in his own life. If you're to be that sort of man, what a sort of man do you need to be? And they revolve around, first of all, verses 3 through 7, his body. Rule your body. And that is speaking of your sexuality. And then verses 4 through 7, which is where we'll be going next, is control of your body so that you are not addicted. The use here is given to wine, the strong drink. That'll be followed then by your sense of justice in verses 8 and 9. What does that have to do with it? Well, we'll see. It's actually very much so that it has something to do with it. And then followed by a word of what to look for in a wife. And that's found as well in Proverbs chapter 31. In fact, there's a whole lot of time spent on that. 22 verses. We'll not look at them, all of them. But I hope to give you the kernel of truth and what it is that you as a man should look for in a wife. All right, last week we looked then at a man and his sexuality. Let's move on to the second area of mastery, and that is the area of addictions found in verses 4 through 7. And what we're going to do to consider this is to go afield. In fact, as I go through these comments, you're probably going to say, what does that have to do with addictions? Well, I think that I'll hopefully be able to demonstrate, well, actually quite a bit. And what it revolves around is the need for a man to work. And you should already see that this has got to be part of it in all that we've been talking about prior to this, the creation mandate being your ruler in your kingdom and getting to work. Things aren't right, so you're going to work to get them. All right, so you can see hopefully already that there's a relationship to that since this is our context. But when we consider man and his need to work, we ought to as well recognize that there really is a problem in our world today. Men failing to be productive. Failing to be hardworking men. Our responsibility in work is to be self-sufficient. That's one. Not depending on someone else. And secondly, to have more than we need for ourselves to be able to benefit others. So we are to be men who work. What I'd like to do is to give you some statistics, and these were brought to my attention in an article by Al Mohler. Al Mohler, you probably know his name. He's president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary down in the States, and he's actually quoting statistics himself. So this is Mohler quoting Jason Riley, who actually wrote an article just a couple weeks back in the Wall Street Journal. In that article, which he entitled American Idol, that is I-D-L-E, clever, isn't it? American Idol, the work ethic goes out of style. The subhead was this. All right, here's the sort of statistics, which is a mind-blowing statistic. 1 in 3 working-age American men aren't so much as looking for a job. Now, as bad as that is, it's actually worse. Because there is a large number of men who are looking for work and for whatever reason haven't found it. But there are 1 in 3 of that group, that whole large group of men, they're not even looking for a job anymore. This is what he says. The premature absence of millions of able-bodied men from our workforce, combined with the continuing retirement of baby boomers and significant reductions in immigration, bodes ill for the country. A life without gainful employment has become a viable alternative for an increasing number of American males. And as I always say at this point, let's not look at our neighbors to the south and go, oh yeah, that figures. I think we would recognize that that border really doesn't make a big difference. That, yeah, it's kind of the same here too. Ironically, I was too lazy to do the work to get the statistics here in Canada. But what this means is that many men are just depending on the government for the social safety net. I think we'd say, yeah, that's true here too, right? He looked at Britain. We think it's bad here. He said in Britain, nearly half of Britain's idle youth, they're not working, now claim to have a, quote, work-limiting disability. That is, that they are saying, I can't work. I'm disabled. Half? So they're basically saying, I'm not going to work. Somebody else can take care of me. I'll live off the taxpayer. But it's not my fault. After all, I have a work-limiting disability. All right, but this is the sort of point that I want to make from that. Those men who aren't working, last time I looked, still have 24 hours in their day, just like every other man. They're doing something. What are they doing? Well, I think there are any number of them who are numbing the guilt of not being self-sufficient and helping others is turning to drugs and alcohol. That's the drink there of verses 4 and 5. It's well noted that depression is often the cause that leads to addiction. And no doubt part of that depression is to cover up the self-loathing over not being the sort of man they should be. Guilt often drives addiction. Now, you'll note there in verses 6 and 7, it does tell us that pain medication or numbing is fine for someone who is physically in pain, especially someone who's dying. I was actually once concerned after the surgery I had on my back about becoming addicted to the painkillers that I was given. I talked with a Christian doctor who was a member here at the church at the time, and he said, no, look, if you are taking care of physical pain, you're not going to become addicted. The problem is, after the pain is gone, if you continue with those medications to mask, he put it, psychological pain. That's the addiction. And so we do have, thankfully, things in our society, medications that are available to us when we have that sort of physical pain. But they're not given by God to kill the pain of a man who should be living, including working. Working towards what? Well, verses 8 and 9 tell us one of the things, a primary thing that we're to work towards. We're supposed to be helping to protect people in society who cannot protect themselves. Like verse 8, people who cannot speak for themselves. And verse 9, people who are not being heard. But in verses 4 and 5, there is the failure that is linked to addictions. You can see it there in verse 5. What is it that they do? The last part of the verse. They pervert the judgment of the afflicted. They don't, verses 8 and 9, speak up for and help those who are afflicted. So that moves those verses in between. The verses in between are just a concession, is saying, hey, by the way, I want you to know, yes, there is a reason for medications that help us alleviate physical pain that we have, like when we're dying. But don't use them as an excuse to not do the last part of verse 5, which is linked to verses 8 and 9. Helping those who are afflicted, and even ourselves mistreating those people. So what ends up happening is this. There's a sort of a downward spiral. A man refuses to work and be the sort of man that he ought to be, being self-sufficient and having more than he needs to be able to give to others. And failing to do that, he becomes depressed. And then the depression turns toward addiction. And that downward spiral leads to more and more problems in society that don't go dealt with. What's the remedy to that? Dirty four-letter word. Well, it's only dirty in the sense that if you do it, you'll get it. That is dirty. And that is work. Work. Work hard. I guarantee you, a man who is working hard has a self-respect that leads him to be a better man. But there also is, found in verses 8 and 9, resident within men, a sense of desire to right the wrongs that are in this world, to take down the bad guys, to rescue those who are afflicted by evil men. We're given that, men. There is within us this sense of justice, that something's wrong and we ought to do something about it. Now I'm going to go afield again. Hope to bring it back in to this passage for application. And I've talked about this area of addiction before. Addiction is something that is endeavoring to replace our sense of doing what is right, failing to do it, and the guilt that results from it. That's quite commonly why we have addictions. The one that's focused on here is drink, alcohol. And I do note that, in fact, just yesterday as I was reviewing my notes, that I probably should have or will speak to alcohol and what we should view alcohol as, how to treat it, how, if we could, partake of it without sin. But it's clearly stated here that if we are having alcohol to dull a psychological pain, or if we are permitting it to keep us from being the sort of man we ought to be, that's wrong. That's the misuse of it. But whenever the scriptures give us this sort of a category, addictions, drink, it's not saying, well, that's the only one that's out there. There are all sorts of addictions that we should be on guard against, that they not so dominate our lives that we allow it to be a something we fall back on when we're not willing to do what we ought to be doing. And whenever we are doing it to dull the guilt of us not doing and being the sort of man we ought to be. So here's now where I'm going to go afield. And I've done it before. And I'll bet there will be some kickback from this, but that's okay. Because you don't have to agree exactly with what it is that I'm about to talk about. But you should at least acknowledge that if it's so that what I'm going to talk about, hopefully you're getting a little bit curious now. If what I'm going to talk about is something that you're doing to not do or to escape being the sort of man you ought to be, then it does apply. Right, what is it? It's simply this. Violent video games. I've zeroed in on violent ones for a reason, but let me say that, you know, it's not just that violent video games would be the category of discussion. I mean, it could be anything, right? It could be fishing. Someone can get so consumed with fishing that they use that as something they fall back on to not be the sort of man they ought to be. Any sort of activity. But I do note that there is, especially with young men, a tendency or activity that is violent video games that can so consume a person that they end up not being the sort of person they ought to be, and that is getting busy working and taking care of that realm of rule that they are a part of, that they need to work on. Now, here's something that I hope will help us to see the link between work and, say, the video games. And it goes back to that article that I was mentioning by Al Mohler. Al Mohler in that article was just talking about work. That's it. He didn't talk about violent video games or video games of any sort. He didn't talk about addictions. That wasn't his point. It would be completely afield, completely a different realm, a matter of discussion that he wasn't interested in. Except for this. Here's a picture that was at the very top of the article, and there was nothing said about it. So why pick that picture? It must be that in the back of Mueller's mind, when he's talking about people not working and bringing in Britain, where young men, half of them aren't doing any job or seeking employment, that yeah, there are 24 hours, they're doing something. And so he thinks, hey, well, is there a picture I could pull out that would sort of show that that's the case? Without even mentioning it. It's there. That's the image he picked. We get back, and I don't know what the next slide is. I'm not that far. Proverbs chapter 31 again. Well, what I'd like to do at this point is again quote somebody other than me. And this is a man, married man, who acknowledged and said, you know what? I failed because of video games. His name is Patrick Lusky. Don't expect you would know him. I don't know him. But what he does say is this: while I was busy helping save the free world, my wife longed for her husband. He was stuck behind virtual, and he adds the word spiritual, enemy lines, pretending to be an elite sniper in war-torn Italy and France during World War II. But he said, the truth is, I wasn't helping save anything. My wife would roll in from her stressful day. She'd see me stretched out and hear sounds of digital death and destruction. Parentheses. I had the decency to pause the action and say hello and ask about her day. What a hero! It wasn't like I was gaming every day. I'd work on a project, work hard, and then chill in front of the TV most days a week. I'd watch some sports, drink in more political programming, and decide to kill Nazis as an elite World War II sniper. How noble! Like I say, I'm no hero. And I'm ashamed that I let things go. Real heroes wield real weapons and do real battle, not virtual ones controlled by thumbs. Heroes carry children to safety and keep them safe. They pay attention to their families, not to their phones or computers. The not so funny thing is that I wanted to be a hero. In my fake virtual world, I fought evil. And the real one, I failed my wife. It's a weird dichotomy, nobility and nobodiness. No beautiful trees, suns, voices, people, places, or reality. It's just make-believe. Then I was restarted, rebooted, and am now being reprogrammed by the ultimate coder. God is not my creator, or rather, God is my creator. But this is no game. He doesn't play games. He does real life stuff. All right, now you can take my application as you see fit. But I hope that you will agree that this passage is speaking to the fact that men have a God-given, not merely responsibility, but something that's resident within their very hearts, a sense of a need to right things that are wrong in this world. Specifically, verses 8 and 9, to speak for those who can't speak, and verse 9, to be someone who does speak for those who cannot be heard or are not being heard. And so we ought to be, as men, those who are willing to take up that mantle of responsibility. Again, I'm not opposed to video game. I'm not even opposed to violent video games. But there ought to be a self-awareness that evaluates our lives and says, am I allowing this to take time away from the job that I'm supposed to be doing, the work that I'm supposed to be doing, and giving that time and effort to something that's recreational? And so, yeah, we have to, as men, look at our lives, and maybe it's just easy for me to say violent video games, because that's not something that's a draw for me. But is there anything in my life that I look at and take as an escape from the real responsibilities that I have? And that my kingdom is going to ruin because I'm not focusing my energy on it like I ought. That's all I'm saying. You apply it to your life as you see fit. But certainly we have to agree, men. Too often that can be us. All right, I've been meddling a good bit in this sermon, so I guess there's no reason to stop now. But it is decidedly tied to the passage at hand in Proverbs chapter 31. And I think that what we find is that beginning in verse 10 to the end of the chapter, that it does speak to us as men, and I will now say especially to you younger men, that it includes that when you have or you take that responsibility on you to be someone who sets his heart on something that needs work in this world to be bettered. And so he goes and he gets it, but that does include a wife. Now, if we'll note here, though, Ecclesiastes chapter 11, verse 9. Because there is a time of life for, now I'll just use young men since I'm speaking to men. There is a time in life for a young man to be wild and carefree. To just go and get it. That is, anything he wants, he goes and gets it. He has a blast. He doesn't have that responsibility on his shoulders. He's just single. I remember times when I was single, I literally didn't have two pennies in my pocket that I could rub together. And I could care less. I wasn't worried about it. I always somehow found a way to get what I needed to get. So you have this in verse 9 of Ecclesiastes 11. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth. Let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. So you get up in the morning and think, what have I got to do? I think I'll go have fun. That doesn't mean you can go sin. That's what it says next. Know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. So, verse 10, remove sorrow from your heart. Put evil away from thy flesh. Because those days are going to end. Childhood and youth are vanity. Do it while you can. But understand it's a time of life. But all good things come to an end. I should be careful how I say that. I don't mean getting married, having family, and that means that all good things are going to end. No, it's a different kind of good. And the fun that you had in your youth is not the sort of fun you're going to be able to have now as a married man. But there are some benefits, some pleasures that are true for a married man. that are not supposed to be true for an unmarried young man. And of course, I speak of sex. Which, if you recall, was back to the very thing that began the chapter of King Lemuel's mother. Don't permit your sexual activity to ruin your life, to take you away from pursuing the proper work in life that you're supposed to. Youth has an endpoint, verse 10. So let's go back to Proverbs chapter 5. Because there is a time when we're supposed to then, as men, buckle down and get on with life. And here we're exhorted, encouraged, warned again in chapter 5, verse 15. Drink waters out of thine own cistern and running waters out of thine own well. This is a picturesque way that the proverbial writer is talking about sex. Let thy fountains be dispersed abroad and rivers of waters in the streets. As in, yeah, have as much sex as you want. And gain the benefit that comes from children. So let them be only thine own. That is, you and your wife. Not having children with another woman. Not the strangers. So what we find is that there is a time in life when God says, all right, for a young man, you're supposed to now stop and say, you know what, I sort of have to get on with life. So I am going to get married, and we will have sex, and if God wills, we will have children. But in that order. So, verse 18, let thy fountain be blessed, that is, many children, and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. So here we have a young man getting married, but all through his life, he's got this one woman that he is having sex with, and children can be the result of that if God wills. Always look at that woman as that woman that you remember when she was young, and so were you. And so we have, in this order, marriage, sex, children, for life. So let her be, verse 19, as a loving hind and pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. So young men, finding a wife and having children, if God were to bless, is one of the things that a man does. Notice here in Proverbs chapter 31, then, verses 28 through 31. And as I noted, there is a whole list of things that you should look for in a wife. And there is, though, at the end, Proverbs 31, verses 28 through 31, are the last verses of it, where he's sort of summing everything up. And what you find there, and it's underlined each time, three times, is the word praiseth, verse 28, verse 30, praise, and verse 31, praise. So we're going to ask, what is it that this woman should most be known for? What is it that people praise her about? All right, what we find is this, verse 28. Verse 28 is not applicable to you as a young man. You're not to be having sex before marriage that results in those children. So the children that rise up and call her blessed, her husband, and praising her, no, that's not something you're going to look for in a wife. You're not going to necessarily look for a woman who already has children. You're supposed to follow that order. Doesn't mean that you may not find a woman who already has children. But this is the order that should be followed, and this is what is not going to happen. She's not going to have, say, your children before you get married to her. But you should have this in verse 31. The fruit of her hands. That is, you can look at her life already, and she has fruit. She's profitable. She's someone that demonstrates that she understands that we're supposed to be productive in life. And she should be praised, verse 30. It ought to be that other people say, you know what, that's a good girl right there. You ought to look at her. She's someone to be thinking about. But it's primarily stated there in verse 30. It's not in the first phrase. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain. If the only thing you're looking for in a woman is that she's a good-looking woman, yeah, you're heading down the wrong path. Now, understand again, she ought to be attractive to you. Not saying go marry an ugly woman. Though if you're an ugly guy, yeah, go ahead, marry an ugly woman. It works fine that way. But that ought not to be the primary thing you're looking at. In fact, if she's not what follows, I don't care how good-looking she is. And now I'll mention it again, my favorite all-time country-western song. I don't like country-western music. Just don't take that personal. It's just not the kind of music I really enjoy. I was listening to a country western song, and I told you young men this before. It's so good. The lyrics of it were simply this: she ain't pretty, she just looks that way. So do not allow a woman's looks to so grab your heart that you don't look at the character that she has. And what is this that is the character there? Well, it's found there in the last part of verse 30. A woman who fears the Lord, she should be praised. So, young men, I encourage you, enjoy the life that you currently have now as a single man, but understand and recognize, okay, there does come a point in time when that period of life is gone, and there's a new period of life that's opening up for me as a mature man. And that includes getting married and having children, if God so blesses. All right, let's end today as we did last week. A big part of being a man in this world is to set your mind and heart on something and then to go and get it. But before you can rule in your kingdom, you have to first rule yourself. Hebrews chapter 12. There in verse 1, we note this great cloud of witnesses. That is that there are people who have gone before you, who have exampled to you that though this is difficult, it's not something that can't be done. Now I could hope for your sake that your father is an example of that. But if he's not, you should determine by God's grace that you will break that cycle. That you will be the sort of man who can be an example to your children, especially to your male children. This is what it means to be a man. That's all it takes, is one person to break that heritage of an ungodly home by having a godly one. So we have the ultimate example. It doesn't matter if you have anyone in your life at all. There is someone, verse 2, that is Jesus. He's the author and finisher of our faith. What did he do? There was a joy set before him. All right, he had a goal, an ambition. He looked at what was wrong in the world and set about to make it right. What level of price was he willing to pay? How about death itself? Not just any ordinary death, death on the cross. It was a shameful death. But he despised that shame. He said, I'm willing to endure that shame. to get what I came here to do. And what happened? Well, he's now at the right hand of the throne of God. He is honored. He's glorified. People come and bow down before him. They give reverence to him. Because he was someone who set about doing what was God's will for his life, he finished the work he was called to do. So he's fit to be the ruler in his kingdom. So we have that example. But we also have this. We have someone who, in enduring the cross, paid for our sin. Because men, as I acknowledged again, or acknowledged last week and acknowledged again, you know, when I rail like this, and I really believe, I'm not apologizing, that the tone of the sermon, by tone I mean how loud I get when I say things, and how harsh I am when I say things, that they ought to match. But in no way do I intend to say, come on, men, be a man like I'm a man. No. Failure after failure after failure. But what do we do, men, when we fail? First, we come to the cross. And there is forgiveness there. No matter what your sin is, there is forgiveness at the cross. That's why Jesus Christ came and died, to pay for our sin. And so we can say at the cross, my guilt is gone because of what Jesus Christ did when he died on the cross for my sin. But then what? It's found there in verse 2. Lay aside those weights and the sin which does so easily beset us. And get back to work. Now the writer here in chapter 12 pictures us as a race. All right, understand that. Life is work. Life is a race. And it's not a sprint. Right? It's a marathon. So keep on running with patience. Endure. That race that's set before you, that goal of working to making the world a better place. So we have the answer for failure, forgiveness. And we have the result that should work out in our life when that forgiveness comes, and that is get back to work. Look at your life. Are you accomplishing God's will? Are you taking the kingdom, that realm of rule, however small or large it may be, that God has given to you, and working diligent, not letting other things cloud, not letting other things take you away from that work? Be the sort of man God wants you to be. Be like your Heavenly Father. Now, certainly these words could be applied in many ways to every person, to woman, child, everybody. But it absolutely does apply as a necessity to be a man. I'll ask, please, Brother Masaru, if you'd come lead us in our final song. And might it be that this would be the motive, the goal of our life, that all we do is done in glory to Christ. Stand with me, please, as we sing.